If you only listen to our podcasts, I want to encourage you to visit unfetteredmind.org. Here you'll find, free of charge, dozens of original articles and contemporary translations of Buddhist texts and prayers. If you find these helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to expand the website and support your practice. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, the nuts and bolts of addiction.
Okay. Though it may not seem like it, we are actually following a progression in this retreat. The first step was to establish a basis of attention. The second is to use that base of attention to move into an awareness of the material that keeps us from being present in our lives, what we've called monsters under the bed, basically the reactive patterns associated with the six realms. And for that we have been emphasizing experiencing how that material arises and manifests in the body for two reasons. One is the body's always reliable. It always tells you what's going on. The second is that by going to the body, one cuts through the conceptual process of thinking, which is spinning around in those stories, which we all know very well, and we all know very well doesn't lead anywhere. And today we spent time in meditation and also in the exercises really getting a taste of the six realms. And as one person said, it was a little frightening how close the artificial exercise was to real life. And this is what's operating all the time. This evening we're going to turn attention to how do you step out of the six realms? And for that, we want to take a look at what's involved. So we're going this afternoon, we're going to discuss what's involved in stepping out of the six realms. What George is going to talk about initially is experientially what happens when you start trying to step out of the six realms and those patterns. And the appropriate model here, interestingly enough, is addiction. And then Claudia's going to talk a bit about the biochemistry of addiction and how that corroborates our actual experience. Notice we're saying corroborates, doesn't cause. And then I'm going to conclude with what happens when you start actually moving out of the addictive behaviors. What's that like? And we'll conclude with the shift in the practice, which will be about it's a form of practice called emptying the six realms, and so it's very much about stepping out of them. So with that basis, I'll send things over to George.
It's going to be kind of halting talk. I'm not sure where to start. I don't really want to talk about myself, even though I'm my favorite topic. But since we're talking about experiential knowing, and Claudia's going to talk about the biochemistry and what happens kind of objectively, or what happens physically, biologically, as a counterpart to experience, I want to talk about the experience itself. And I came from a long line of alcoholics, and for a long time, I drank quite a bit too. And the way I dealt with that addiction was basically I didn't go anywhere where I couldn't drink. So parties without alcohol, you know, not much fun. Don't bother with those. Going on a road trip, going camping or whatever. Always make sure you have the flask of whiskey. And I wasn't like, I wasn't an alcoholic like my father. I wasn't actually getting in trouble and, you know, crashing cars and going to jail and, you know, ruining things. But it was, at some point, I had to admit that it was an addiction in the sense that it controlled someone by behavior. It influenced my decisions. It influenced the way I enjoyed things or didn't enjoy things. It influenced, obviously, the people around me. But I, at that point, I wasn't really aware of that. It was me and my personal chemistry that I was concerned with. When my father died, of course, I got drunk, first thing, and then I got on a plane and dealt with the funeral, etc. When I got home, within a few months, up until that point, I had always quit drinking, and I would also quit smoking cigarettes at least once a year, maybe for a week or two or three. And I joked about it. At the time, it was kind of, it was my way of bringing my tolerance back down, so that I didn't have to drink, you know, 6 or 10 beers, or I didn't smoke a pack a day. I would just kind of grit my teeth for a few weeks each year and you know, straighten out my addiction so I could continue it at a more satisfactory level. But after my, well, it's about maintaining, right? Maintaining a certain body chemistry, maintaining a certain lifestyle, maintaining a certain social interaction. Yeah.
Are we on? Yeah, thank you. As George is talking about this, translate what he's describing into your relationship with certain reactive patterns that you know well. They don't necessarily have to be an alcoholic or a nicotine addiction. Just certain reactive patterns which you have said, you know, have been the basis of your New Year's resolutions for the last 25 years or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so just translate it into that context.
Yeah, something you'd like to stop doing. So, and that's Ken's interjection is also a sign that time has passed while I've been sitting here talking. Because alcohol is actually not my point. After my father died and I realized, okay, you know, there's like two kinds of people in my family. There's the alcoholics, and most of them are dead. And then there's the people who stop drinking. And I thought, well, I think I'll join that group. So I quit drinking. And it was actually easier than I thought it would be. But I had a lot of other things coming together at that time, like I started practicing seriously. And I met Ken. And so I had somebody who could teach me how to practice, so I wasn't just reading the books and kind of doing it on a, you know, do-it-yourself basis. And so I quit drinking alcohol and I quit smoking cigarettes. And the freedom, the sense of freedom that came from that really surprised me. It actually wasn't that I wasn't drinking anymore. It was that when I came home from work and there was only one beer in the fridge, I didn't like have to go back out and go get more beer. When I went camping and my cigarettes got wet, that wasn't the end of the camping trip. So I wasn't taking care of my addictions all the time. So that was kind of the first thing, besides not being drunk and not having so much conflict and all the consequences of drinking, just the freedom itself was a payback. But within a few more months, I started realizing that actually alcohol wasn't my problem. That I had some other habits, and they were not as visible, certainly not to other people, but they hadn't been as visible to me. And I started becoming aware that a lot of my life was based on addiction. I was addicted to anger and the adrenaline, the rush that accompanies knowing that you're right and putting some idiot in their place. An actual physical rush that was just irresistible. Even though I woke up the next day with what was starting to become as bad a hangover as the alcohol, with, you know, being tired and my jaws were clenched if I'd been in a shouting match, and the shame and the embarrassment and the need to, you know, go back and repair things and, you know, mitigate the damage. It's like, wow, this is like getting drunk, you know, getting angry, losing your temper. So I started working on that. Books, movies, so much of my life was, and you know, the addictions get more and more subtle, is what it is. I'm peeling them off layer by layer, and I'm discovering that each of them, actually, there's a lot of similarities. There's the need to avoid something. There's the need to engage the behavior, even if it's disgusting or problematic. There's the rush when you do engage in it, and the kind of the justification in the moment where it just seems right. You know, it's going to be this way. And then the loss of time while I'm engaging in the behavior, and the loss of awareness of other people and everything else that's going on, the passage of time. And then when I wake up from the behavior the next day or a week later, the whole hangover and having to deal with that. So it can get pretty subtle. It doesn't have to be alcohol and cigarettes. It doesn't have to be dry alcoholism and, you know, rages. It can be always watching a movie, the only thing that relaxes you. You know, it's only twice a week, but if you feel uncomfortable not doing something, there's an addiction on some level going there. And that discomfort, we're going to talk about that too, the discomfort of the hangover, the discomfort of the withdrawal, the discomfort of quitting the habit, all uncomfortable, but they're all different. And when you're in the grip of the addiction, it's very difficult to make that distinction. The rush of losing my temper was as powerful as the rush of taking a drink. And the hangover of losing my temper was just as bad as the hangover from alcohol. And the freedom also from dealing with one is just as liberating as dealing with another.
George, just a quick question. I get it, except for the movie part. If you like watching movies twice a week, what's the problem with that? What kind of, you're going to wake up, what are you going to wake up feeling badly about? That's the one thing I just didn't get. Yeah.
Well, as I say, it's more subtle. Better to watch a movie than get drunk. Both from the point of view of addictive behavior and how to deal with it, also from the point of view of the consequences. But I have many intentions to spend time with people or to work on something that needed work on, to study something that was meaningful to me. Many times, many evenings have been spent watching movies instead. Not that I'm a Puritan and want to work so bad, but again, it's that irresistible activity. You have one intention, and then something else happens because it just feels right. And then afterwards, there's that little niggling inside that there wasn't really a choice made. If you're watching a movie out of choice, that's different than this is the way Friday nights are.
Yeah. one of the definitions of addiction is a mood-altering behavior that you engage compulsively that has detrimental consequences for your life. So if you simply enjoy watching a movie, no problem. But if you're using it to avoid things and there's a detrimental consequences. I have a friend who recently spent 3 months on Second Life instead of doing some translation work that he'd contracted. That would not be exactly just enjoying things. Okay?
And that, of course, is the purpose not only of, you know, alcoholism and you know, the heavy-duty things that we recognize as addictions. That's the function of any habitual pattern, is avoidance of something. And if the addiction is, I mean, you know, if you're, as we used to joke, me and my buddy, drinking buddies, oh, it doesn't matter if you want to go out drinking tonight. If you want to be a drinking buddy, you got to, I mean, we got to keep this up, you know. It's like, you know, you got to have a drink, you got to stay in practice. And that's the whole, that's a pattern. It's an addictive pattern. If it's working for you, then you're avoiding something. You don't know you're avoiding it because you've blocked it out. Some aspect of your experience or some obligation or some intention that brings up things you don't want to deal with is being avoided, so you don't have to deal with it. So it's not the movie, just like it's not having a glass of wine. It's the compulsion that drives it. And the repetitive pattern, what that does not only to your life, but emotionally, mentally, and biologically, which Claudia is going to talk about, the repetitive pattern itself is addictive. So I didn't want to drink anymore. I don't want to lose my temper anymore. I don't want to have to, you know, watch movies to avoid taking care of my house. But it feeds on itself after a while. And that's precisely the purpose of it. It's not an occasional enjoyment. It's a habit that avoids something. So it's easy to say, you know, crack addicts or alcoholics or this or that. And we have, you know, the judgment around addiction. But the model, physiological, emotional, and mental, holds, whether it's having to be nice all the time or getting crocked. From the point of view of a habitual pattern and avoidance, it can be accomplishing the same purpose. Somebody who has to rescue people all the time because they can't face, you know, seeing other people in pain, becomes an addiction, and it's problematic, either greater or lesser extent. So I had a bunch of other things to say, and I can't think of what they are. My time's up. So
this question is from Gary in Northern California. What is regret? I have had too much to drink tonight. That gives you perspective of where I'm coming from. Okay, here goes. When you are looped, do you see things more clearly? Not sure. One does things they would not normally do. I just spent a wonderful evening listening to a jazz singer and her group and getting high on margaritas. Right now, I have a big band playing hot jazz on my computer. That certainly keeps me going. You have no idea how difficult it is to keep typing when one has had too much to drink. Now, before the listener wags the precepts at me, think about it. Can one realize anything when they are drunk? A serious question, really. I am asking it. Remember Trungpa. We get so serious in Buddhism with death and all. Ken, are you willing to address this? Look forward to it and whatever comments or admonishments you may have. Forgive any lack of clarity and such. I will always regard you as my teacher.
A bit too much to drink. Hey, Gary. Well, I wonder what you really want to know here. Alcohol loosens inhibitions, both physical and mental. And hence we have that wonderful expression, in vino veritas, in wine there is truth. So it can allow people to feel and experience and open to things that they wouldn't normally. And as you say, they may do things that they wouldn't normally do. But this is induced by the alcohol. It doesn't mean that there's any freedom there or any presence. There is a long tradition of Buddhist teachers who drink too much. But I'm not sure we're talking about those people today. The fact is that most people drink to escape something. And as Piet Hein said, every man, before he dies, should know what he is running from and to and why. So I invite you to take a look. Why do you get drunk? What does it serve? While you may see things differently when you are drunk, it also helps you to avoid experiencing something else. And I think that something else could be very useful to know what it is. So I invite you to explore that. I suggest you explore it sober, because there is no stability of attention when you're drunk, and I don't think that will be very fruitful.
This question is from Sherman in Atlanta, Georgia. I've been addicted to internet pornography for many years. I'm deeply ashamed to admit this, but I know that shame is tangled up with the addiction. The form this takes is usually one lengthy session of viewing pornography every week or so, followed by feelings of mortification and despair. My addiction draws me deeply into various hell realms every time I do it, and for a long time afterward. I've had a daily meditation practice for 1.5 years. As I start to feel more openness and fluidity from it, I'm thinking that perhaps it might help with my addiction. In some small ways, perhaps it has. I can locate the precise moment that the impulse to view pornography arises, and I can feel the emotions associated with that moment, but I still can't seem to do anything about it. And of course, when I'm actually doing it, I feel nothing at all, no attention and no awareness. It's clear to me that I'm seeking this oblivion, but there's also something very mechanical about the whole process.
Addiction is very widespread. It's also very difficult to deal with. And everybody has to find their own way. You've already done some very, very good work here. And I want to highlight a couple of the things that you've already accomplished, and then offer a couple of suggestions about how you can continue. First, when you say that shame is tangled up with addiction, shame is very, very much, one could even say it's at the core of addiction, that addiction usually arises when there are experiences one is not able to take in, and so one forms a relationship with a substance or a behavior that it takes you away from that experience. It's a way of shutting down. And one approach to working with addiction is to develop the capacity to be able to experience that core shame or the what was you're unable to take in. you've already started to move in this direction with your meditation practice. Because further on you say, I can locate the precise moment that the impulse to view pornography arises. That you've been able to locate that is very good. And what I suggest here is that you stay, you even recall that precise moment sometimes in meditation, and learn how to just experience those emotions. Starting with your body, so that you're grounded in the body, that's going to give you more strength to your attention. And then open to the emotional elements, and eventually include the stories too. And I want to emphasize here that it's not moving from the body to the emotions, to the stories. It's first the body, then as you stay present in the body, include the emotions, and then as you stay present in the body and the emotions, then you include the stories. So it's an accumulative process, not a movement from one to the other. And as you say, at this point, you still can't seem to do anything about it. This means that your attention is sufficient for you to be able to recognize what's arising, but is not a sufficient. There isn't sufficient energy in the attention to give you alternatives in behavior or to cut the process itself. So, and you're completely correct when you say, when I'm actually doing it, I feel nothing at all. It's a kind of oblivion. It's a shutting down. Now, usually with things like pornography, there is a very significant element of objectification of the other, the female or whomever. And that's and often that objectification comes about because of being objectified oneself in some way. So the final suggestion I have for you is that as you move more deeply into this, you may find it very very helpful to sit down with a therapist or a skilled counselor who can start working with the objectification issues that are probably contributing to this pattern of behavior. But I do want to emphasize, and from what you sent here, you've already done some very good work. Keep moving in the sense of opening to the emotions that you're aware of being based in the body. And I hope through this that you'll discover more openness and fluidity and a wider range of options.
Jim in Columbus, Ohio writes, my question is about working with shame. In Wake Up to Your Life, you wrote, if you don't open to every aspect of your life, energy fuels precisely what is not open. This is the dynamic of addiction. At the heart of most addiction is the core of shame. As long as you don't open to that shame and experience what it is, a self-image trained into you by your family or cultural system, it runs your life. Can you give some pointers about how one can begin to open to this core of shame? It seems that shame, by its very nature, resists being known and will put up a hell of a fight if to anyone who tries.
Well, the first piece here is not to regard the shame as an enemy, which you're going to get rid of. Because one way of understanding this is that being swallowed by that shame that was trained into us was how we survived some very difficult, painful, unpleasant situations. So the whole pattern around shame is all about survival. And if you now threaten the shame with its own extinction, you simply trigger the survival mechanism. And as you say, it puts up a hell of a fight. In fact, it wins, hands down, because it knows how to do that. So, first is not regard the shame as an enemy. And that can be difficult because it can be so intensely unpleasant. And here, my suggestion is that you open or allow it to open gradually in its own time. Elsewhere in Wake Up to Your Life, you may read that I talk about attention being like the sun and patterns being like things, frozen water, ice. Now, as the sun shines on ice, the energy in the ice molecules is gradually increases. And when there's enough energy, the water molecules cannot stay in the rigid structure of ice, and the ice breaks up and becomes water. So one holds the shame tenderly in attention, allowing the sun of attention to gradually act on what is there. And to mix metaphors horribly here, then the shame is kind of like a flower bud, which in the rays of the sun opens in its own time when it's ready. You're not trying to force anything here. And it can take time and patience. And you're not really trying to get rid of anything here, but just experience what actually is there to the best of one's ability. I've also found that there are usually many, many layers here, so it's often not the case of just working through and then you're done. You work through a layer and you open up a dimension of freedom that you didn't have before, and then sometime later you find yourself working on the same issue and you feel, gee, I've forgotten it. But you haven't really forgotten it. You're just now capable of working at it at a deeper level. And this can go on through several different iterations. And with the release of each layer, one finds a new dimension of freedom and possibility in one's life.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.